You don't see police. People look happy. So therefore, to conclude that what's implied is that nothing is happening here. And then they might also even say that. They may get Uyghurs, other people from the region, to say the same things. But that's ignoring the fact, according to the state documents, that around 600,000 people have been formally prosecuted in the region since 2017, and that they have assigned around 3 million people to jobs. That's their way of framing a kind of unfree labor system where Uyghurs have no choice but to go wherever they're told to work, in securitized factories apart from their families. They're also not pointing out that there's 800,000 children in residential schools at this moment. So all of those, institutional facts of violence that some of, is according to the United Nations meets the definition of crimes against humanity. That's something that you're not going to see in a vlog post that's celebrating what's going on, according to a Chinese perspective. And then there's like, it's a big country. There's other parts of the country that look quite different. There are other Muslim groups, the Hui Muslim group, who hasn't been targeted to quite the same degree. And they speak Chinese. They can pass as Han. They don't have their own homeland. They're in some ways less connected to other parts of the world, other parts of the Muslim world. And so there's lots of ways that you can kind of spin a narrative that would try to dismiss this. But to do that, you're ignoring the facts on the ground. You're ignoring the voices of Uyghurs who are in diaspora, whose family members are in these camps or in prison.
And I know it's not just Uyghurs. There's also the Kazakh minority as well has been also persecuted by the Chinese state, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So the Uyghur region has around 15 million Muslim people in it. Around 12 million of them are Uyghur. And then there's a million and a half that are Kazakh and another million that are Hui, which is this Chinese Muslim group. The Uyghurs are, their ancestral homeland is in the southern part of the region, which is a very large space. It's, probably as nearly the same size as British Columbia. And so in the north of the region, which is on the border with Kazakhstan, that's where the Kazakh population lives. In those areas, Kazakhs and Hui people were also targeted, and it seemed because like the local authorities were given a mandate of to find 15% of the adult population that are extremists or terrorists. And so, if you don't have Uyghurs to frame in that way, then you need to find the next available Muslims, which are Kazakhs and Hui people. Many of the Kazakhs were detained because they had used WhatsApp to contact their family members in Kazakhstan, or they had traveled to Kazakhstan, which is a banned, it's a flagged country because it's a Muslim majority country. Very, arbitrary application of law, not even law, was used to make these decisions to detain people, to send them to factories, all of that. It's really part of an internal colonial project of removing the indigenous population, these Muslim peoples, from their land and opening up that land for a settler population.
And moving on to Canada comparisons, seeing how surveillance has been rising, do you think Canada could apply this as well? And if so, how would it look like? And can it still be democratic while applying it without sliding into authoritarianism?
You're asking if Canada can apply surveillance, with surveillance here, and without it moving towards authoritarianism. Well, I mean, Canada is already using surveillance to a certain degree. Mostly it's being used in crime investigation, but it's also being used to vet migrants, asylum seekers, people coming into the country as part of background checks. There's the capacity here already. Like, if the law changed, if a switch was flipped, that we could be tracked to a significant degree. So, our license plates can be read, as we're driving down the street. There's face recognition capacity, as you're especially in high density areas like in downtown Vancouver. So they could begin tracking people's movements if the system changed. I think there is a significant concern around that among Canadian lawmakers, that not happen. And so there are a lot of safeguards, political safeguards in place that prevent the most egregious forms of abuse that surveillance can be used to do, used to enact. In the United States, I think it is rapidly moving more towards the Chinese position, where they're now tracking people's political speech, they're searching people's phones, they're building databases of people that protest or undocumented people. It's very alarming to see that democratic backsliding. I think Canada so far has not looked as though it wants to move down that path, and said it's trying to distance itself from the United States in some ways. But of course, we're part of the same intelligence establishment, we're part of the Five Eyes. We share information with the U.S. at times, at least, and it's very troubling.
The United States has actually started implementing real surveillances, because I have heard about them tracking phones, but that's actually a real thing that's happening.
Well, they're searching people's phones as they enter the border at spot checks. I don't know that they're tracking people as they, regular citizens, as they move through space to know where they are in real time. I think if you're on a watch list, that's definitely possible that they would be doing that kind of tracking. And some of it, they are using a legal frame that would allow them to target non-citizens. So if you're, an international student, for instance, then you can be tracked in a way that a citizen is not supposed to be tracked without a warrant or without the right paperwork, permission from a judge. For undocumented people, they are definitely tracking them. Yes, mm-hmm. For sure. And, they force people as they come into the country to download an app onto their phone called CBP1, which is using face recognition, and then is can be used to track people's movements as they enter the country, who they're connecting with, their social network. It's then used as ICE is doing these raids in different locations. That's the kind of information that they're drawing on to decide where they should target people. There's a lot of opacity in how all the operational uses of this technology, but there's the contracts are there. We know that they are using these kinds of tools. It's more the specificities and the scale at which they're using them that is less clear.
And since Canada is choosing China primarily because China's economy is powerful and moving from the United States, however, due to China's human rights violations, should Canada reconsider, or should they separate human rights concerns from trade relations?
I mean, that's a tough question. I guess there's a couple ways to answer it. One is that my personal view is that I wouldn't buy things from China personally, and don't think Canadians should. At the same time, canola business is a $5 billion business. And if you're not able to trade with China, send that to China, that's going to really hurt the economy and hurt specific people. People will lose their jobs. I don't think that moving towards China is a long-term strategy. I think it's not the path we want to head down. If we need to diversify our economy, we should move in different directions and build alliances with nations that don't have horrific human rights records, where they're actively interning populations, where they're unapologetically doing that. I don't know that the specific aspect of your question is should it be separated? I think we should have economic sanctions on China, in the same way that the United States has done that. I don't know what it means to sanction a country and then also trade with them. So to me, it feels like a that there could be a different strategy that we would want to pursue. Maybe someone else wants our canola. We should be finding other people to trade with.
Well, Canada has also diversified its trade with the European Union and other Asian countries. Could they just continue doing that instead of trading with China?
I mean, I think that's a possibility. It's just that the Chinese state is one of the largest economies in the world, but it's one of the largest populations in the world. And I think there's not really other states where they have sort of the market capacity to absorb what Canadians are making. The US, ha or sorry, Canada has built relationships, new trade agreements with states like Korea. And maybe Japan as well, and Europe, but I just think that we need to find other ways of driving our economy that don't depend on trade with China, and that means some longer term thinking, what that means.
I mean, I definitely do agree that sanctions should be in place on China, but is there like a type of, I would say there are countries that are kind of scared to go up against China because China's like a pretty powerful country. Do you think that various countries, like especially Western countries, because they like to talk about how they care about human rights, so why can't they stand up to China despite everything? Like, why can't they just like, I don't know, tell China straight away?
Yeah, well, I mean, China is a very powerful country. It's in terms of its economic force in the world, both as a market and as a producer. It has been the factory for the world, and that is changing. Like, the production is moving to other places. It's beginning to move to other places like Vietnam or Bangladesh. If we would be willing to pay more for our fast fashion for our consumer goods. That might even move more quickly. I think Western governments, middle powers like Canada, the government is mostly there to secure the economy, make sure that the economy is stable, that it's growing. And so the political will of like standing up to China is sometimes not there. I think some of this is about domestic politics as well. Like, what the Liberals ran on in Canada was economic strength, and so if they are then turning to human rights as being their primary concern, which of course they would say it is, it has always been, they would say it's our core value. But if it's too core, then I think that would open up them to a lot of criticism, and would make the stability of the regime suspect, perhaps. So that's I think the cost benefit sort of things that they're weighing and when they're making some of these decisions. The sanctions that the 100% tariff that China put on canola was because Canada was standing up to China in the past, and now it's saying, "Oh, we're not going to stand up quite as to the same degree." And so, I think Canada has already seen some of the cost of what it would mean to stand up to China, and now they're saying, "We did, maybe we went too far." That's the message I think that China's getting from this.
I mean, would you call China kind of like a regional bully, especially in Asia Pacific, especially with the way they're threatening Taiwan and repressing minorities? Is that like behavior of a bully, you would say?
I mean, China is pretty aggressively expansive in how it's looking at the world. A lot of it is driven by domestic concerns. So, the economy is stagnating in China. They've kind of built everything they needed to build in China. They have an oversupply of both workers and capital. And so that means that they need to go out into the world. They need to invest everywhere else in order to kind of keep the economy going. That's why they decided to make electric vehicles at the scale that they have. It's not just for Chinese consumers, it's for the world because they can. And so that outward look, outward demand in order to keep the domestic economy and domestic political situation stable. makes them act like a bully. I'm just saying, like, it's not as though they're like saying like we're gonna bully you. It's like there's an economic incentive for them to do what they're doing, and like that's probably the primary driver, and then it comes across as bullying. And it literally is that. So like at the United Nations, like countries that are now dependent on China for trade, especially in the global south, they know they can't cross China. They can't vote against China because that will affect their trade relationship with China. And so there is like real leverage, which is, I guess, the leverage of a bully. They don't like they bully people kind of behind the scenes. It's not the same way that Trump is doing it, where he's like yelling at people, yelling at countries. It's, yeah, Xi Jinping can, I mean, we just saw it in domestic politics where he's like, got rid of all the top generals, like with, by lifting his finger, basically. Like he has extreme forms of power. And he should be thought of as like, a mafia boss who's like, pretty like a Zen mafia boss or something.
And well, I definitely will say that there is like, I guess, a double standard with the way I guess Western countries, approach human rights concerns, because they kind of like, I guess they are aware of China's human rights violations, but they like don't really care enough about that.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is also that it's kind of far away. It's like, out of sight, out of mind a little bit. And then there's, lack of knowledge. There's the sort of smoke screen of Chinese disinformation that would maybe allow people to sign off on this and say, well, we went and it looks like things are fine, or like this isn't, it's not as big of a deal as what the, what the journalists or Human Rights Watch are saying. There is absolutely a double standard. I mean, like, we would never allow countries or a province in Canada to do, sorry, companies or a province in Canada to do what China is doing. Like, we would never, the kinds of human rights violations that are happening in China are, at a completely different scale than what is happening here in Canada or in the US. It is what we did in the past, when during the sort of the height of settler colonialism, when there was genocidal violence towards First Nations people, like, that's the kind of thing that's happening in China right now. And so, if we are, not supportive of colonialism, if we are not, if we are championing human rights, I think it's a state that we shouldn't be involved with. As much as we can. I mean, it's the economy is very complex and interconnected, and it's really hard to extract yourself. But there are choices you can make even within that complexity.
So, what's happening to Uyghur people? Like, you do agree that there's definitely like genocidal intent from China's part? Because I do hear that it's like equivalent to a genocide, and that's why I'm wondering.
I mean, proving intent is something that I guess international law, scholars should really, be adjudicating, because they're the ones that can make that determination. We see very clearly, like, state documents saying who should be targeted, that they're saying 10 to 15% of the population. We see them talking about, what should happen in the schools, which is, removing children from a minority from the targeted group and giving them to the majority. Which is, one of the definitional, like, factors in genocide. So it meets many of the markers of what constitutes a genocide. The main difference is, from some other genocides, is we don't see mass killing, like intentional mass killing. But the basic definition is destroying a people in whole or in part, and when you're destroying their families, when you're eliminating their language, there's destruction happening. So it certainly seems as though they're being intentionally targeted. The state would say, we're just doing counterterrorism. These people just happen to be Uyghur. They just happen to be all from the same ethnic group. They would talk about it as a sort of necessary evil, maybe at worst, or just as like standard operating procedure for they would keep maybe backward people or underdeveloped people.
Mm-hmm. So I guess my final question would be, like, in the long term, what would this really mean for Canada if we continue to, I guess, trade with China? And will the international community, like, ever finally, like, stand up to China and actually do something about this?
Well, I'll start with the first part of this. I think if we normalize our relationship with China, we are normalizing what China has done and is doing. We're acting as though it's okay, that it doesn't matter, that Uyghur lives, don't have value to us. And there's lots of other people that are being targeted and suffering in China as well, beyond the Uyghurs. It's many, many reasons why you would want to not associate yourself with that as a state. So I think we do need to, not stick with the current plan long term. I don't know that the international community is going to ever have the political will to stand up to China, and to really force a change on this issue, or even if they can force a change on this issue. There's so many other things going on in the world that people are concerned with, and people are most concerned with things closest to home. So, if the United States is sort of on fire with political turmoil, people are not going to be able to look outside of that. In Europe, Ukraine is a much bigger issue. What Israel is doing to Palestinians has also taken up a lot of space. And those are just like the sort of conflicts in the world that aren't like the more racialized conflicts of, what's happening in Sudan, what's happening in Ethiopia, where people are also being killed at immense scale. And the world seems completely oblivious to it.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like it's unlikely that people will be willing to sort of bear the cost of standing up to China in a very aggressive way. I think, though, that like there has been some real reputational damage to China through all of this, that like many states are now much more reluctant to work with China than they might have been 10 years ago. And I don't see that changing either. I think people are worried about a future where China is increasingly more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
They're just balancing other concerns at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So I guess another final question I would definitely say is that China also is, I would say, complicit in other dictatorships, because they do sell their technologies, like surveillance technologies, to Israel, to Iran, to like basically other states, so they can surveil their populations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of what I'm seeing being done to Uyghurs, at least in the camps, for instance, is what Russia is doing to Ukrainians as they're deporting them, putting them through filtration camps. They're using exactly the same technology. And in Israel, Chinese companies that built these safe city systems and camp systems in Xinjiang are building, the population sorting systems in Hebron, the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's, the automated or automation-assisted targeting systems that they use to perpetuate a genocide against people in Gaza. In Iran, they're doing the same, yes. So, I think China is complicit in selling these tools, which are not so different from things you can get from the U.S. or from Israel. The main difference is that they're built at the scale of population. They're cheaper. They're being mass-produced. And they come with other incentives, trade incentives. So it feels as though what we're seeing in China is kind of the future of policing, the future of political systems. There is a real threat to democracy that is moving through the world. And China is one of the primary actors there.
Mm. All right. Well, I guess that's all I really have. Thank you so much for your time.
Sure. Yeah, I was happy to speak with you. Thanks for your questions. It was an honor.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you to Senya and to Darren for that interview. You can find that and more on our website at cjsf.ca. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. I'm Jesse. And we're going to wrap up the hour with a little bit more music. And then you'll hear Democracy Now in its usual 11 a.m. spot. This is from the upcoming record, A Party in Her Name by Hillsborough. This track is called Whoa. See you next time. Have a great long weekend.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In June and July, billions of people will watch the FIFA Men's World Cup, united by their passion for soccer, or football as it's known in most countries. And a nonprofit called Football for Future is mobilizing this huge fan base as a force for climate action. Founder Elliot Arthur Warsop says climate change is already harming the sport.
With extreme weather events becoming more intense and more frequent, whether this is very extremely hot temperatures, whether this is the pollution in the air from wildfires, or whether this is waterlogged pitches or crazy storms that make travel impossible.
As the climate warms, teams will likely encounter even more days when extreme heat or flooding interferes with practices and games. And a recent report co-authored by Football for Future shows extreme heat will hit hardest in the global south, where many legendary players got their start. So the group educates fans about climate change and recruits players to call for action.
I believe that football is the most powerful social phenomenon in the world. The global football community are so many and they are so powerful.
And when they come together to shoot for climate action, he believes they will win victories around the world. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Hi, I'm Chef Robert Rainford. Nearly one in three black children in Canada goes hungry while food gets thrown away. The Food Security Fund is changing that. led by Support Black Charities, the plan is to build a better pathway from community gardens to nutritious meals through local food hubs. This isn't just charity. This is community infrastructure. Join us and build a better future for Black families to have consistent, dignified access to good food. Join us at foodsecurityfund.ca. Contribute today. Thank you.
The Slate Family Foundation Legacy Program was created by the Unison Fund to support Canadian music industry veterans. For more information on this lifeline of hope, visit unisonfund.ca.
Hi.